Hi, Killjoys. Rachel here with a brief message before we start the show. So the Feminist Killjoys PhD podcast has partnered with its very first sponsor, and I hope you all know that Melody and I would not participate in sponsorship if we didn't actually believe in what the sponsor was doing. So I'm very proud and excited to share that we are currently sponsored by the MA in Critical Studies program at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, because we need to interrogate, intervene, and reimagine like never before. For more information or to apply, visit pnca.edu/criticalstudies.
You're listening to Feminist Killjoys PhD, an hour of feminism, pop culture, and politics as discussed by two professional killjoys.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Melody.
And today we will be discussing class, definitions of class, class transitioning, and so much more. But first, Melody, where can our listeners find us on the internet?
You can find us in select places. Let me list some of them for you. You can find us on your favorite podcast application. A lot of you like iTunes. I use Overcast, your choice. You get extra FKJ points if you leave us a review on iTunes, and it's also a good way to spread the word about our podcast. And then on the social media tip, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can like our general Facebook page for episode updates. And then you can also join our community group, which is Feminist Killjoys Community WTF Power exclamation point. And shout out to that group today because we got a confirmation of an amazing episode topic through y'all. So thank you for that.
Snappies.
We really do listen.
We do.
By listen, I mean read. On the Spotify, you can find our mixtape titled Feminist Killjoys PhD Mixtape. It is a collection of our outro songs, which Rachel and I are going to have a conference about because we're having some copyright issues. I can tell you all, I can give you a lecture on why, what law it was in which we're having copyright issues. But anyways.
I love that Melody knows that because I'm just like, let's just like ask forgiveness, not permission. Forgiveness, not permission.
Doesn't work like that in the copyright world.
Nope.
Anywho, besides that, if you have any extra dollars and you want to support us feminist media makers, you can visit our website, fkjphd.com, and you can click on our Patreon logo, which will set you up for becoming a monthly micro donator. $1 a month or more gets you access to the Killjoy newsletter. $5 a month or more gets you access to bonus apps. We're going to record one tonight. What it will be, you'll have to wait and see. And then you can also find the birdie on the website and click on it and give us a one-time donation. Both we mucho appreciate. And if you want to just send us some personal mail, which y'all do, shout out to the people who emailed us this week that we owe emails to, that our address is fkj.phd@gmail.com. And if you'd like to go super lo-fi, you can call us at +1 414-858-7818. What's up, Rachel?
Thanks for that, as always, informative and important spiel that you give. I also just want to clarify, like, I care about artists and copyright for people who are not millionaires, but oftentimes we're using... The times that we get called out on SoundCloud are people who have a lot of money, which is, like, great transition into our topic for the show today. But anyway, I didn't mean to be flip about, like, caring about copyright because I know it's important slash also, like... I don't know. It's interesting. Melody knows a lot more than I do about all of that stuff. We should have an episode on it. Anyway, I'm actually very good. I'm actually very good this week. I had my very, very bad week and made a decision to be in a better place. And I am. And I know that that's not always possible for people. But for many reasons, I've been able to do that. And that's good. And what are some specific updates? It's Oscar weekend. Longtime listeners and IRL friends of mine know that I fly my mom to wherever I'm living to watch the Oscars with me because we've been doing that since I was little. Unfortunately, her flight got canceled last night because we've had some major storms on the East Coast, but she will get in tomorrow morning. So she will still be here. We're recording on Saturday, so she will still get here in time for the Oscars. I'm continuing to see some Oscar movies. I just saw Call Me By Your Name today and really enjoyed it. Really, it's a beautiful, beautiful film. And what else? I'll stop there. But I'm good. I'm good. How about you? I know it's been kind of a tough week for you.
Yes, but it's also been sometimes, you know, bad things make you better or something, make you stronger. Or I don't know. It adds more complexity to your life. Anyways, more on that in a second. But today I had a really good day. It's actually, the snow is melting today. And so that means biking weather is pretty good. So I had a good time biking around today, which makes me feel good. Exercise is good for me. I'm starting a new research project with my students next week. We're going to count. We're doing a content analysis of newspaper articles about the WNBA team, the Minnesota Lynx, and then the NBA team, the Minnesota Timberwolves. And we're going to count how many stories the Star Tribune does for each team. And there's a whole bunch of different categories we're going to code for.
That's rad, Melody. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, hey.
That's so cool.
When you have 67 people at your disposal, and you want to teach them different research methods, like doing content analysis is like perfect for that.
Totally.
If people aren't familiar, content analysis basically means you count a bunch of shit. Like you count how many times they say Muslim and terrorist in the same news story or something, right? So it's like not the brain power comes in like counting stuff, and then the data itself shows something. It reveals something.
Right.
And so this is a well-known research strategy, but it is time intensive and also can be resource intensive if you're just one person.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Dr. Ruth DeFoster, who wrote this amazing book called Terrorizing the Masses. And one of the chapters, she herself coded cable news stories about the Black AME shooting in Charleston and the Pulse nightclub shooting. And she coded, I don't even know how she did it. Like, she did
so
it herself.
Much. Yeah.
Because she's an adjunct, so she doesn't have access to research assistants.
Ugh.
Oh, I'm going to make a note. We got to rant on that later because, seriously, that's one of the most annoying things about class privilege in academia.
Yeah.
One of the many.
Absolutely. But, yeah, love her. She's a former guest. Y'all should search for her name in our archives. Well, that's great that you're doing that coding project. I think that'll be great for the students. And tell us what you find.
I will. I can probably already guess some of the things I'm going to find, but we'll see. Yeah. Because it's one of those things where we're very qualitative people, you and I, and we like to analyze representations. But people like to see the data.
Right.
And people are, you know, Cheryl Reeve, the coach of the Lynx, is always like, you all don't cover us enough. But she hasn't sat down and counted the stories,
right?
So we're going to count the stories and we're going to actually see if there's a discrepancy. There totally is.
Yes.
But we need to know how big the discrepancy is.
Yeah.
So.
Great.
And I'm excited for the Oscars, too, because I like live tweeting them. And I know we have a full schedule. Can I just complain? Can I just killjoy one thing?
Of course.
I saw this ad on Instagram. I don't know if anybody else did. It was from ABC. And they're like, will these actors make history? And I swiped and it was all pictures of African-American or African actors, which is awesome, right?
Yeah.
But they're like advertising the fact that the Oscars have been so racist that Black people don't get awards. So now there's an advertisement about tuning in to see if the Oscars won't be racist anymore.
Yeah, it's gross. I mean, it's gross. I'm fully accountable to that. I am complicit in like this like gross Hollywood thing. Yeah.
Oh, I did not say that to
I know that. I know that. I'm just saying that I am. But just how gross it is that this show in 2018 is gonna have like firsts of Black people winning. Yeah, it's gross. And the fact that it's an advertisement is especially gross. Blech. I'm glad you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is the perfect audience to share that with because I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're advertising that the Oscars are so racist that they might not be racist this year.
That's ridiculous.
Cool, guys. Awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's been your part of your week. I know.
Oh, yes.
We want to make some time to talk about a hard thing that happened this week.
Yes, thank you for giving me the time. So this is actually an excellent transition because I want to talk to you about my student, Victor, and it would be very much like Victor to come in with that same kind of critique anyways. Mm-hmm. So like we're on the same page for sure on the criticizing the mainstream media. But Victor was one of my students, and I'm talking to you because he passed away this last week, but it was kind of an intense thing. I've never lost a student before, so I just wanted to take some time and tell you about him. He was actually, I found out at his funeral that he was in my class the first semester I taught at Anoka Ramsey.
Oh.
He was my a student in in my class the first semester I taught at the school that I'm at. And then he didn't pass the last semester, so it'd be the fall semester, he reappeared on my class list and he was in the class again. And he was 4 years older and said, you know, I have my shit together now. I'm here. I'm going to make it. I'm going to succeed. And I was like, all right, that's cool. You know, I was really happy to have him in class. And he was funny because the first couple days in class, it was like the Victor show because he really, really, really wanted to be a DJ, a radio DJ, like at a hip hop station. And he wanted to be a rapper. And he was super smart. So he was sharing like all of these things that he knew about the industry. And I didn't shut him up because I was like, well, we're going to learn this in like 3 weeks. So just listen to whatever he's saying, you know? And then, you know, he was just like one of those like really, you know, the super critical thinkers in class that always offered up that like counterpoint. I don't know. So he was just a rad student. But then he kind of phased out. I'm sure this has happened to you, like the students that are like doing really good or they're fighting, trying to get through the class. And then he just started kind of disappearing kind of slowly. And as professors and teachers, if you're listening, you might know there's, well, I have the struggle of like, do I put my teacher hat on and let him do the self-responsibility thing that he came to me with? You know, he's like, I got responsibility now. I'm going to get through this class. Or do I check up on him and kind of push him to get back in the class? And within academia, there's always somebody that argues self-responsibility is good. And then there's always somebody who argues, no, you have to keep up with them and like get them to come to class. Like it's really important. But for whatever reason, at this time, I was like, you know what? He said he wanted to do it. He had self-responsibility. It's one of those things like, do you let them suffer the consequences or not?
Right.
And at that moment, I chose to let him suffer the consequences. And he just, you know, he just became less vocal in class and just kind of faded out and he didn't pass the class. But then it was like February 19th or 20th, whatever that the Tuesday is of that week. And I was at a teacher's development day. Actually, it was faculty and staff. And one of the keynote speaker was Dr. Wood, and he specializes in Black men and Latino men in college. And he does a lot of work on community colleges. So obviously he was a great keynote speaker. And as he started to talk and to show the, we have a dismal graduation rate for Black men in our, well, Black people, they didn't have data of men and women, but dismal. Like our graduation rate is 15%, only because there's a lot of people that transfer. So graduating isn't necessarily their goal. But if our graduation rate is 15%, our graduation rate for Black people is 2%.
Oh, man.
So that's a disparity, even though our graduation rate is low, right?
Right.
And so immediately I thought of Victor and I was like, man, like, I did him wrong. This is, like, some regret. And so I got out my computer. I was at the conference, and I was, like, searching, trying to find his email. And I couldn't find his email address. It wasn't coming up in the school thing. I was like, oh, maybe he's not registered this semester. I was like, oh, I'll find him later. I'm, like, at this conference. I should be paying attention to this African-American man talking to me. I probably look rude. So I put away my computer. It turns out that the night prior, he got in a car crash, head-on collision, and died.
Yeah.
And then Tuesday morning, like, I swear, I wish I would have tried to email him so I had a timestamp. I swear the almost to the minute that when I was trying to reach him is when the news reports were published with his name.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad I didn't Google him because that would have been like super traumatic. But then Wednesday when I got to school, I had, you know, I had no idea. So Wednesday I got to school and thankfully it was after I taught and one of my students from my class that he was in came up to me and said, hey, did you hear about Victor? And I said, no. And he said, he died in a car crash. Mm. And I was just like, can you imagine?
I mean,
to hear that a student died, no, anyways, but like.
To have just had him on your mind.
Yeah. I was just thinking about him and worried about him and like mad at myself, you know, that I didn't.
Yeah.
Because basically what Dr. Wood was saying in the session was like, you have to get in their faces.
Yeah.
Like, you have to. And I'm like, I did not do that with Victor. And so processing all that shit, you know, it was like.
Yeah. Well, you like know, really, I mean, really a car accident of all things, obviously that's not, that has nothing to do with like whether or not he was enrolled this semester. Like, I hope you're not blaming yourself.
Oh, no. It's just one of those.
Just regret in general.
Like,
I get it.
a general regret. Like, I had this, you know, just last semester, I was thinking to myself, what am I going to do with Victor, right? And I had that, I had two options, right. And I clearly remember choosing one, right? And so it's more like a, why didn't, like, what, if I would have reached out to him.
Yeah.
I mean, he knew that I cared about him, but he also, like, he has a Twitter account, and some of the, you know, one of his last tweets was, like, pretty dark about how he felt that people saw him. And I was like, one of those things where it's like, I really hope that he doesn't think that. I hope he didn't think that about me.
Yeah.
That I was one of the people that, like, didn't see him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I went to his wake on this Wednesday, and that was just, like, awful because it was open casket. I didn't know. So I got to see him.
Yeah.
But at least I got to, like, talk to him, you know? And then the funeral was on Friday. And because the wake was so hard, my partner came with me on Friday, which was really nice because I was all by myself at the wake. But I was about to sit down in a pew at the church, and one of my students, Hans, was there, and he was like one of his like really good friends. And so we got to at least, this is why I'm like, well, it was sad. I got to sit next to Hans and like comfort him, and you know, we sat really close to each other.
Yeah.
Like, and it just, it was really sad. It was so sad. He has a baby sister, and just like, he was just going to be somebody, you know, and his family was talking a lot about how he would watch documentaries at home. And like, what I was thinking about, especially with this topic today, is that people like Victor cannot get through a traditional college class because
of all the other shit,
a myriad of all these reasons, right? But he was smarter, or like knew the material more than anybody else, because he self-taught, which is what I know that Black communities talk about self-educating. And so like, what is that? You know, I just was thinking about him, like, what does it mean? Like, his class privilege got him nothing.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't have class privilege. He's from Kenya, and he's very proud of his heritage. And his parents immigrated from Kenya. So he's like first generation American. And even with the support system of a family and church, like, college is just not set up for people like Victor. Yet Victor was smarter than a lot of people in my class. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Success is based on showing up and doing these stupid assignments, which in hindsight, you know what I mean? Like, he was
completely
an A student.
Yeah.
If I didn't have to like judge people based on the curriculum or whatnot.
Exactly. Completely. I've had those students too. And I'm just so sorry. It's tragic.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to, what am I trying to do? Well, I'm starting to draw a picture. I put it in our notes.
It's beautiful. I'm looking at it right now. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
So I'm going to finish coloring that. And then I want to write him a letter and put it at his, he's got a grave site right by my school. So I'm going to go visit him there. And yeah, it was just nice. It kind of helps when you can help other people. So it was nice to be there for Hans.
Yeah.
And Hans is from Cameroon. I'm sorry. He's from Cameroon.
Okay.
And so I met his mom, and his mom was like, I met Hans's mom, and then Hans's mom was like telling me stories about like East African and West African food. And I don't know. It was just nice to just
be in community and
And I got to meet a student's mom, and she knew who I was because he talked about me at home. You know what I mean? So it was just like, at a time in which I felt like I failed a student and now he's fucking dead, I was reminded that like,
you make a difference. You have an impact.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So
yeah. And knowing you,
you
were not one of the people who made him feel, I'm sure that he felt seen by you, you know?
Yes. I was just worried at the end.
Yeah.
You know, like when students start ghosting and I'm like,
I know. Ugh. I know. I've been in that same boat.
So anyways, that's Victor.
Thank you for letting me Of course.
Share my story.
Of course. It's really, it's just tragic. And I, knock on wood, haven't lost a student. So if anybody out there listening has, maybe you can provide some words of empathy if you'd like to reach out to Mel.
Yeah. And I will say, one last thing, and then we can transition, that like, this is really like one of my worst nightmares. When the Black Lives Matter movement had a lot of visible press and we were talking about it in class, like I was worried that one of my students was going to show up, like would be dead.
Right.
These are things that I like actively have anxiety about.
Right.
Like I tell my students not to text and drive, and I have no idea what was going on with Victor he crossed the lane into the oncoming traffic.
Yeah.
But that's all I know. But like when I tell my students, please do not be on your phone when you drive, it's because I care about them. Like, right. I will, please do not die. Like, this is, right. it's really awful, especially at a community college. You just get to know your students on a different level. Yeah. Or I guess I should just say the way that I teach. I just try to make personal connections. So
yeah.
I guess I'm facing one of my nightmares, and it's not, I'm living, I'm existing, I can
right.
function.
Right.
But it's like, ugh, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. And it is kind of a transition. You teach at a community college and you witness low-income people every day who are mm-hmm. kind of doing this kind of class transition thing that we're going to get to in a moment. That was sort of the impetus of the topic today. I made sort of a shorthand comment about feeling last week when I got news that I didn't get the job, that sort of in my depression spiral, I had this feeling of like, I will literally never be able to class transition from growing up poor, and that it's just, I'm always going to be poor, just having that feeling. And I just sort of said it, and folks responded to that. So we wanted to address that, what we mean when we talk about class, what I mean when I identify as working class, what class means in different contexts. We know most about the U.S., but we had a lot of commenters talk about Europe and immigration and class. And so we'll try to bring in some voices from our Facebook as well. But Mel, do you want to share sort of your relationship to class growing up and now, just briefly? We'll sort of both give our...
Yeah, so I don't think I've really shared my class story much.
I'm not as vulnerable
as you on the podcast.
True.
So I have this really weird class position because, to put it succinctly, I grew up in upper to middle class neighborhoods, and I went to a very nice school district that gave me a very good education, in which most people that graduated high school were going to college. And if you weren't going to college, you were seen as less than. So I grew up in that scene, that culture. But at home, we were told and we witnessed that we didn't have money. And so it was a very confusing way to grow up because we didn't know how to perform middle to upper class culture. Like, we didn't have people over. We didn't have nice things. My mom would complain that we never had any money. The secret was that she just mismanaged money. She didn't have like a drug problem or like anything, or a gambling problem, but like she mismanaged our money and we just never had money. And so I grew up with the privilege of the middle to upper class, but the at-home stuff felt very similar to when people share their working class stories. I can relate to a lot of that stuff because I'd get really excited about going to my dance class, but then my mom would be complaining about she can't afford the costumes. But then we were living in a house that was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like just so confusing, but we really didn't have any money. It wasn't like she was making me feel bad and then she would pay. Like, they would ask me like, hey, is your mom going to pay the bill for the dance class? And like, so I was going through those things that working class people did, but under the facade of being middle to upper class. And after high school, in terms of, I know you talk a lot about not having a net to fall back on, a safety net to fall back on financially. I'm in the same way. Like, my mom has no money. I give her money, if anything.
Yeah.
And I've asked my dad for money before, and he said no. Like, there was this one summer when I was between jobs, because it's always so annoying, we don't get paid in the summer.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to have a job, but transitions between jobs can be really rough.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no savings because I was coming off of a grad school thing.
Right.
And asked him, I thought he had money, and he said, no, I can't afford that. And so I would just call, I'm totally fine identifying as middle to upper class because all the privileges that come with that I've had.
Mm.
But at the same exact time, I don't have parents that I can ask for money. My partner is actually the one person that, like, if I needed money, I could get, like, his parents would be a safety net.
Yeah.
Which I'm grateful for. That's one of the reasons we can have a house.
Yeah.
And not be in debt to a bank. So that's just a privilege right there. Like, we could have afforded a mortgage, but because his dad has so much money, we can just, he's the bank,
yeah.
You know, and then we don't have to pay such high of an interest rate. So that's my thing. I don't really know how to describe it, but the one last thing I'll say is that my dad, I've been poking at my dad about his history, like his upbringing, and he definitely grew up working class.
Yeah.
But there's something about in the 90s that he was like, I'm out. And he like got a job That was his focus. He got a great job. He got us into good schools. But then, like, his dad was a car mechanic and his mom stayed at home. I mean, they were working class. But so there's this interesting class disassociation going on, too, that I'm kind of processing in my 30s. So
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all that. I think what is interesting about so many class narratives these days is that it isn't this black and white thing, which is, you know, most things, most phenomena in culture. Because I, even though I grew up, I think, in more, I mean, we didn't have a nice house. We moved in multiple houses. I lived in apartments. I lived in, my mom and I shared the bedroom in my grandma's house. Like, we've lived all over because we had, you know, couldn't afford things. And so, and I mean, there's a whole host of other things that I can talk about. But what I'm trying to say is my connection to you is that I did have access to middle and even sometimes what felt like kind of upper class things. So my grandparents were very culturally middle class. They really liked the arts and could afford to travel sometimes. So I would go to Canada to see, and I lived in Cleveland, so Canada was a car trip. It wasn't like a fancy flight. But we would drive to Canada to see a Shakespeare festival. And so I grew up with this kind of culture when I was with my grandparents. And my mom liked it too. But my home life was, prior to my dad getting hit by a car, he was sort of a very prototypical, he drove stock car, race cars, drank beer, worked on cars, he had a blue collar job, listened, I just remember his garage, hearing Metallica and seeing hot babes in bikinis on, you know, sports cars or whatever. It was just very stereotypical kind of white trash stuff. And that was sort of the neighborhood I grew up in. My early life was with very working class, white trash, rural. There were farms around us, very what people imagine sort of like Roseanne, except even Roseanne's house was big compared to what I grew up in, but that kind of culture. But then I would go to my grandparents and we would, you know, talk about theater and all of this stuff. So I did have access and knowledge of that, so that I was already navigating these two different worlds even as a small child. But then that was, you know, the juxtaposition of going days occasionally without having utilities because we couldn't afford to pay for utilities, and shopping at thrift stores and just being so traumatized that I couldn't get new clothes. And I remember being an emo punk when shopping at thrift stores was really cool, and my mom being like, oh, now it's okay for you to shop at thrift stores, because I would throw fits about it when I was young. And so, and all of this was compounded by the fact that I only had income from one parent, and her jobs have always been very working class. Anyway, all of that is to say, I also navigated some interesting dynamics of understanding something outside of white trash life, but having also the very real lived experiences in my home life of actual poverty. I mean, food stamps, not having utilities paid, and so on. And today, my mom's situation, unfortunately, has only gotten worse. And she's older and disabled, and her job, the only job she's been able to get for a decade, pays minimum wage and, you know, gives her shitty hours. And, you know, she's on Medicaid. And so I also financially support her when she needs it, which is lately more and more often. And occasionally she listens. And Mom, I love you so much. And I hope you know that this isn't a shame thing, because I know that it's capitalism and not you. So just shout out to my mom. So that's kind of a short version. Other stuff I'm sure will come up. Anything else you want to say before I sort of transition into?
No, I guess maybe the theory will help. I feel maybe this is just something to ponder and let me know if there's theory. But I think our country doesn't talk about class enough, and so I'm glad that we're talking about class. And then to add it, I think class is on a spectrum, right?
Yeah.
And it's been hard. It's hard to articulate, because when you say you're working class, or I say I'm middle to upper class, right? That's only telling part of the story.
Right.
And so, I wish that there was more words to describe, a complicated class background or something.
Totally.
Because I just don't have space to identify in this, I would never, ever identify as working class, not because I'd be ashamed of it, but because that would just not acknowledge my privilege. But at the same time, there are some elements of my growing up that are working class, and just how you were explaining, the cultural middle to upper class stuff that you had access to, right?
Yeah.
So that's just something that I just noticed a pattern in our stories, and I just wanted to pull that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I obviously, last week when I said I feel like I'll never class transition, that was truly it's my trauma brain spiraling and catastrophizing and thinking about, you know, making hyperbolic statements. The truth is I absolutely have class transition culturally and in terms of the way that education provides these bridges. So my entire life is my entire lifestyle is very middle class. Like, you know, looking at my apartment and what I do, my yoga, you know, all of this stuff is very, very middle class seeming. So absolutely there are ways that I've class transitioned. And yet the lack of upward mobility feels sometimes insurmountable. So we can unpack that more. In terms of what you said about the fact that we don't talk about class a lot in this country and wanting more complicated terms to identify it, I think is a perfect point to get into a Marxist definition of class, which is one reason I think we don't talk about it, is because everybody's afraid, you know, there was the Red Scare and communism. We actually talked about class quite a bit. The early labor movement was actually, early unions were pretty militant and radical because they were founded by communists and anarchists, and class was very much part of popular discourse. And then during the Red Scare and the sort of push away from that, we start to see this subtle shift that gets just bigger and bigger up through what we now sort of call like the neoliberal era of totally moving away from this notion of working class identity and just even discourse to really make a blanket statement that sort of everybody is middle class. Even labor unions in the U.S. talk about supporting the middle class, which is, if you are a Marxist or a communist, a disservice to the struggle of identifying the working class, which according to Marx is literally anybody who doesn't own the means of production. And that is a very reductionist, very Marx-era understanding of the way that sort of labor and ownership operates, because the means of production becomes more complicated in sort of the era of tech and all of these different sort of things that are outside of like the factory owners and the workers. But if you understand the working class as literally anybody who isn't an owner and who isn't profiting off of the labor of other people, then we actually have this like huge number of working class people who could like literally rise up and revolt if we all cohesively identified as working class, because we understood that our labor is being exploited. We're not exploiting other people's labor. So, and then we can talk about the, if you really, there's also like the petite bourgeois, and there's a lot, there is some nuance in Marxist theory, and also the lumpen proletariat. So there is some nuance that he brings into his stratification of class, but mostly it's like the working class and the bosses, basically. And there's value in that in terms of social movement organizing, because it's like we could literally get everybody fucking together to rise up against the owners and take the power away from that. So that's Marx. Socioeconomic.
But,
go ahead. Yeah, jump in. No, jump in, please.
No. I will, in our social media, we'll have to share that image of the Marxist. Like, there's this really cool image that really helps exemplify this, where like the people on the bottom layer are like literally lifting up the people above them. And then, have you seen this before?
I have.
In Carol Stabile's. Okay.
Yeah.
To finish my thought, Carol Stabile's house, and I would like stare at it.
Yeah.
And that's how I like figured some of this stuff out. But also, I think, as you're saying this, and I know that you know this, what really fucked it all up is this American dream myth, or like,
exactly.
You know, so my students are like, no, I'm getting out of the working class. Like, I'm just working at McDonald's so I can start my own business, or like be middle class or upper class.
Yep.
Right. So we have this desire to move up, let alone we're all fucking, even if you do move up the ladder, you're still getting fucked over by the bosses.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Anyways,
exactly.
Just wanted to add that.
Totally. Totally. And that has been, part of the fabric of the U.S., forever. Yes, absolutely. So the American dream, and that's also become woven into the U.S. labor movement, which sort of like I think is a bad move for the labor movement. Anyway, then we have the sort of more like sociological, like what is your class, like what is your salary? How much money do you make? Are you below the poverty line? Are you above the poverty line? And that economic stuff feels really tricky to me, too, because that doesn't take in. Some studies will, but if you say I make X amount of money, you might also be riddled with student debt. You might live in a city that is exorbitantly expensive. You might be taking care of a child or a parent. And so when you make X amount of money but have all of this other shit that you have to pay, you're not actually taking that money in. So like actual just like salary number feels like a fuzzy way to identify class too, because there's all of this other shit that goes along with it. And then cultural is another definition that I want to bring up of working class, because it is something that I do adhere to. I feel culturally identified as working class in the same way that I identify as queer. It's part of my identity. It is my roots. I feel like it influenced me in the most impressionable time of my life. So I have PTSD from a number of things that are poverty related. And I also have just a lot of very ingrained, deep held beliefs and ways that I move about the world that are deeply influenced by growing up around the kind of people that I grew up. So that manifests in my approach to sharing resources, the way that I dress. We talked about this on our tattoo episode. Like I consider my tattoos very related to my class identity, et cetera. And there's a lot of really beautiful writing about things like your class lives within you because, you know, working class people, their teeth are fucked up because they couldn't afford braces. So like class is embodied and you can't ever escape it entirely. Even if you transition fiscal, even if you get more money in the bank, you can't necessarily ever escape that working class roots. And for me, it became like a term of really empowerment and something that I'm like, I fucking like love my working class roots for how they really brought me to political consciousness. Honestly, I mean, that's being working class helped radicalize me. And just the love that I have for a lot of the working class cultural things that I grew up with, in terms particularly in the ways in which I learned about helping each other, like helping people was such a prominent part of my, like I lived on the street called Tinker's Creek Road, and the amount of people who slept on our couch was just, I can't count how many people slept on our couch because their husband was beating them one night or because they couldn't afford, you know, they got kicked out of some house or they couldn't afford rent or whatever. Just like the taking care of each other thing feels like a big part of working class culture to me that I'm proud to possess. So those are some breakdowns, marks, socioeconomic and cultural.
While you were talking, I was reflecting on my own class connection and how conversely I want to disassociate from being middle to upper class, having that background because like it taught me everything I didn't want to be. So while you have like positive connection or some positive connections to the working class culture, mm-hmm. It was like I hated growing up where I did.
Yeah.
I never want to go back to the suburbs. I never want to go back to the places where middle upper class people live. And if people are like, why does she keep saying middle upper class? Because I think it's sometimes we weren't just middle class. Like we had like some of our houses were very big. And the place that I went to school was very nice. Like I complain a lot about growing up in the suburbs. But one thing that I will never complain about is the education I got.
Yeah.
I got zero cultural competency mm-hmm. education. I had to figure that out very quickly in college. Mm-hmm. Like it was very whitewashed education for sure. But that education set me up for a lot of success in life. And so I acknowledge that. But everything else about that world, I can't stand. I would never want to do that. But then I hate this term when people commit class suicide. I wish that there was a different way.
Yeah.
But when people on purpose, I don't know, there's some activists that I know that, you know, they're like trust fund kids that are trust fund kids, but they perform as if they're working class and they conduct their lives in a way that will never get them to CEO jobs, you know, in whatever way. And so I was just thinking about that term too. That is not something that I did. I obviously have a PhD and like I'm a professor and I'm not trying to do that at all. But that was just another term that I thought of while you were talking, kind of the converse.
Totally.
Of, reconnecting to your roots. So
that's my
additional thoughts.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking.
Yeah. So that, I think that's a good way time to jump. There's so many other things we can say and remind me that I want to talk about how it went from like talking about working class to talking about middle class. But then, well, I'll just say it really quickly. So honestly, I would, as a social movement scholar, I would credit Occupy Wall Street as bringing class back into the forefront of popular discourse. And I would also credit Occupy Wall Street for getting Bernie Sanders to be a viable candidate, because the concept of the 1% and the 99% was not being discussed prior to Occupy Wall Street. So that conversation class has come back into the picture, I would argue, largely because of Occupy Wall Street. But this idea of when you were talking about the class, quote unquote, suicide, which really is, that's awful. So sociology talks about social mobility in terms of horizontal social mobility, where you move from one position to another, but on the same level. So you're just moving horizontally. And then vertical social mobility, when you transition from one position to another, but situated at a different level. So it could be a move up or a move down. So what you're talking about is when folks move down. But for me, that feels so dramatically different, primarily because the anxiety, like, first of all, your developmental years, you didn't get the sort of trauma of poverty, which is scientifically proven. Mm-hmm. but also the anxiety of not having a safety net. And I know, I also want to say this, that when I said that thing last week, again, it was sort of my offhand, like, this is how I was spiraling. I know that it's much more complicated than this, because I understand that even if you do have a safety net, even if your parents have money, for example, that not everybody can ask their parents, not everybody's parents will give them that money. I get that. And also there is the lack of anxiety because, you know, if push came to shove, like, I think a lot of folks who are listening who are like, well, I would never ask my parents for that money. I think if you were literally homeless, you know, you would have, and this is not the case for everybody. Some people have really horrible relationships with their parents because their parents are not, have not been good to them. And I'm not talking about you. But I think there's this like, oh, I would have a place to go and I probably would get money because it's there, because the money exists. And again, that's not everybody, but there's generally like, if there's money in the family, you're probably going to be okay. And I will say that I have an uncle who is kind of that to me. He doesn't have a ton of disposable income, but he has a house. And so he has property, which is different. So that's another thing. Like, if you have a family house that your parents own, the way it usually works with class is that when your parents pass away, you will get money from that house. So that is not that I don't have any like there's that doesn't exist with my mom. But so this idea of downward transitioning feels like, I guess, kind of. But also you have like this, there's still wealth in the family. So that's the difference between wealth and class. Like, you can have like a lower income job, but you still have wealth in your family. And unless you're truly excommunicated from your family, that will probably benefit you in particular ways. And then on the opposite end of that, when you don't have wealth, even if you economically transition, that lack of wealth, that's what makes the class transitioning feel impossible sometimes. Does that make sense?
100%. I really like the example of if push came to shove.
Yeah.
You know, like if push came to shove, I was like, I had no money. I had $50 left in my bank account. Like, my mom would have nothing to give me.
Right.
You know, but like my dad could figure something out.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, he could do that. Or like with Dakota's parents, like there's money, there's wealth.
Right.
In the property, in the investments, in.
Right. That's another thing. That's this. I have to tell this story. This is wild. Co-lead, I'm coaching yoga teacher training at my studio this round. And we did like an intro activity where you write down like an icebreaker question on a piece of paper and you throw it in the middle of the circle and everybody grabs like a piece of paper to answer. And the question that I got from some person in the room, and I highly doubt this person will be listening, but if you are, you're not a bad person. This was just very interesting to me. They asked, what are your top three favorite stocks to invest in?
And I you kidding me?
I'm not fucking kidding you. And I was like,
okay, A, I can't answer that question. But also B, what the fuck?
What
you're
the
in a yoga.
Fuck. I know.
What did you do?
Said I didn't know how to answer that question. And that if anybody wanted to teach me about Bitcoin, I would be interested to learn. That was my answer.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And like those two. Okay. Yeah. That really exemplifies how little you know.
Yeah. Isn't that like an investment?
Kind of. No, it's a currency. You don't usually invest in currency.
But oh, okay.
It is an investment right now.
All right.
Hey, I don't know anything either, but this is so to prove, make the point in a less silly way. If I wanted to make a shit ton of money, I could just go talk to Dakota's dad and he would hook me up. You know, I'm not fucking investing in cigarette companies
right.
and oil companies and all that stuff.
Right.
But like, I have access to that education.
Right.
Where for a lot of people, there's nobody in your life that has that, nor do they even have $25 to take away
exactly,
and invest.
Exactly. This has been the most wild thing of when I did admittedly class transition. There was one year that I was trying to figure out my taxes and I'm like, I'm just going to fucking, I was single at the time. And admittedly, I've often relied on partners to help me with taxes. So I was like, I'm going to go to H&R Block. Like, when I say I can afford this, it's like, I'm in debt with student loans, but you just sort of pretend that that's not real and doesn't exist so that you can like do these things, which is, I think, how a lot of us live. So I like went to H&R Block and they, you know, I had this like old white guy who was like trying to tell me things. And he's like, well, you know, we can start an IRA for you. And if you put this amount of money in, then you get a tax break. And I was like, wait, what? And so I started learning about like, if you have even a small amount of money, I think I put like, I had like $400 that I was able to like give to that and get like a break on my taxes. And I was like, wait, so if you have money, then you don't have to pay as much money. And he was like, well, yeah. And so I just learned this whole world of this. And it's the same thing when I learned about, like, I'm going to give some education because if you're fucking working class, you probably don't know this. But if you start a fucking savings account, like, interest also fucking baffles me. Like, the more money you have, the more interest you will accumulate. But that is just, like, so fucked to me because the people who need money are poor people, not people who already have a lot of money. So, like, taxes and interest and this thing that is an IRA that I don't really even understand, but it happened because it gave me a tax break one year. I was like, okay. But it's been baffling to learn how the more money you have, the easier it is to not have to spend your money. And this has also been wild for me because this year, without a salary, making very little money, I had to pay $4,700 in taxes this year.
No, you did not.
Mm-hmm. Over that. That was for the IRS. My state one was another $600. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to be totally blunt with y'all because I'm a free contractor for Core Power. They don't pay any taxes. So all of the tiny money that I made from them this year. Yep. And the other money I got, and the other money I got was from freelance writing. So I've been getting this non-taxed income, which is not accumulated to very much at all. And now I have to pay that amount of money back, which is just wild to me because my partner, who is making a lot more money than me, is getting money back. And it's just what? And the same thing, I'm sorry, I'm going to rant a little bit longer. I've been trying to get my money from my mom, money from the government for years. She is disabled. She is literally in poverty. And getting her any money from the government has been like pulling teeth. It's like something goes wrong with the paperwork or some office that is supposed to help her doesn't send the paperwork to the office that is supposed to sign the thing. Like it's just, or she gets denied or she's not disabled enough, which is the case with her disability right now, which is just fucking absurd. But when I lost my job, I was able to go on unemployment for a few months before I started adjuncting again because I made enough money to be considered worthy of getting unemployment. But my mom can't go on unemployment because she's never made enough money to be considered worthy of getting money from the, because technically, I guess my taxes have gone to that when I had a salary. So that's another thing that's infuriating to me. It's like I literally benefited from the government for a few months. And I've been trying for years to get my mom money from the government. And we're still trying to get her even just food stamps, which is absurd because she makes so little money. She should have had that a long time ago. So anyway, that's infuriating about our system and just demonstrates another way that, like, once you are poor, it is so difficult to become less poor. And once you are rich, it is so easy to become more and more rich, or once you're even middle class. It's fucking infuriating.
That's why Jay-Z gives advice to young Black people to invest their money. Like, he put it into that song, The Story About OJ, The Story of OJ. Like, he's, like, trying to get people to understand, like, this is how you make money. This is how white people make money. You invest and you invest and you invest because, like you said, like that knowledge doesn't get spread around, you know? And like, of course, rich people get richer. I mean, the system is just set up that way.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are ways that you could use the rich people's tools, but nobody teaches poor people the rich people's tools because then things would become more equitable.
Right. But if you just learn the rich people's tool, I mean, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house, as Audre Lorde said.
No.
So, like, you're just going to continue to create that gap. And actually, it's funny you brought up OJ because I was revisiting Bell Hooks's Where We Stand, Class Matters. And do you mind if I just read this because it's so apt?
Please do.
So Bell Hooks says, class matters. Race and gender can be used as screens to deflect attention away from the harsh realities class politics exposes. Clearly, just when we should all be paying attention to class, using race and gender to understand and explain its new dimensions, society, even our government, says, let's talk about race and racial injustice. It's impossible to talk meaningfully about ending racism without talking about class. Let us not be duped. Let us not be led by spectacles like the O.J. Simpson trial to believe a mass media, which has always betrayed the cause of racial justice, to think that it was all about race or it was about gender. Let us acknowledge that first and foremost, it was about class and the interlocking nature of race, sex, and class. Let's face the reality that if O.J. Simpson had been poor or even lower middle class, there would have been no media attention. Justice was never the central issue. Our nation's tabloid passion to know about the lives of the rich made class the starting point. It began with money, and it became a media spectacle that made more money. Another case of the rich getting richer. The Simpson trial is credited with upping the GNP by $200 million. Racism and sexism can be exploited in the interest of class power, yet no one wants to talk about class. It is not sexy or cute. Better to make it seem that justice is class-free, that what happened to OJ could happen to any working man. So she's not about that Jay-Z learning, teaching them how to invest life, I don't think. I mean, I don't know if she would be well, she also said Beyonce was a terrorist, so Bell Hooks has some Bell Hooks might have some issues with the Carter family. But my point there with that is,
quote, Bell Hooks may have some issues with the Carter family, unquote. That's great.
That's the newsletter title. That's the newsletter title for this week. I think what she's bringing up, aside from just like the OJ moment that was such a good connection, is there are these ways when this is how I teach neoliberal feminism to my students, is that, and I think I've said this on air before, that there's like, if you go to like a feminist bookstore, you might see like a pin that says my favorite position is CEO. And it's like, that seems like a, you know, like, hooray, women. But actually, that is, you know, being a CEO is oppressing the working class. And you can't have a victory over patriarchy if you're simultaneously upholding capitalism. So even though I think we all need to fucking survive, and if in learning how to invest is a survival tool, far be it for me to say don't do that, but that's not remotely challenging capitalism, of course. But neither is not investing, I suppose. So I don't know. What did you think about that Bell Hooks quote?
I don't actually have much to say. I mean, it's Bell Hooks, what yeah. she says stands. I really like Bell Hooks.
Yeah.
She clearly has issues with the Carter family, but yeah. like she's right on. Like, yeah. How do you feel about how she defines the white patriarchy? Blah, 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 blah.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
I like it. Sorry. I wasn't prepared to have like a response.
No,
like,
no.
I'm not. This is like grad school. Like, I don't know how I feel. I just really like it.
Oh,
I'm hungry.
Totally.
I'm not actually hungry, right. But yeah, like.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I've been a little bit scattered jumping around, but I think I wanted to like define those different approaches to defining class. I wanted to talk about like the live reality. I can talk about some other like live reality of the ways in which it feels impossible to class transition is like so often in college. And this obviously I class transitioned because I went to fucking college. I'm in debt forever, but I went to a private college that I got a great education at. But I remember when people's like parents would come into town, it was like, oh goody, don't have to pay for anything all weekend. And there was actually my mom had a decent job for a little bit of my college life, but like now, I mean, when my mom comes to town, mostly it's like I pay, like I buy her plane tickets.
So
it's
my mom doesn't pay for anything,
right? It's like, and my mom wants to, and when she was able to, she did.
Same.
But but so just those moments of it's like parents don't equal getting free things. Like what in what world? And that's similarly all these fucking news articles that I hate because we're technically millennials, which is kind of still weird to me. But all those articles that are like millennials are the first generation to be poorer than their parents. And I was like, what fucking millennials are you talking about? Because there have been poor people exist in every fucking age. So like, don't fucking tell me that millennials writ large are poorer than their parents, because there's millennials that grew up in poverty and they may or may not be poorer than their parents. Like, I hate that that is the discourse of like the way that class works also, because that suggests that capitalism like only hurts people in particular generations when it has been hurting people as long as it's been in existence, because capitalism relies on having poor people, period.
Can I go back to something that you kind of mentioned, but I just wanted to tease out a little bit more when you're talking about your experience growing up,
mm-hmm.
about how people were sleeping on your couch. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of one of the reasons why I love my neighborhood. And one of the reasons I would never live in the suburbs is that people help each other out.
Mm-hmm.
Like we all share our resources mm-hmm. together. And I think you had, I don't know if you spoke this, but I saw it in the notes that like the resources within working class communities just get depleted because
yep.
people help each other out so much.
Exactly.
And I actually had somewhat of a class-based tiff with my partner who doesn't listen to the show, so I can just say whatever I want. I pay kids around here to shovel, mm-hmm. even though we love to shovel. And they're African-American and, like, come over with socks as gloves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and yes, I'm getting them gloves, people. They're like, why don't you just go buy some gloves with your professor? I am, okay? But also, I give them a lot of money. Like, we're not the... They have a house that is full of rich people that give them more money. But I give them way, like, a lot of money mm-hmm. to do this. And my partner was like, we could just do it. We don't have to give them the money. I'm like, yeah, but we have the money. And, like, I will, right. I'm going to give them money to shovel. Like, yeah. I see it as, like, some, like, reparations. That's my personal thing. It's like, just fucking take the money, please. But also... He learned from his father that you squirrel away your money. Nobody gets your money.
Right. Right.
And I saw that in him. Like, that was learned behavior. You know, it's like, completely. What the and we never had any money. Like, we didn't have money to give people when I was younger. And I actually was told when I went to DC when I was in fifth or sixth grade, scratch that, seventh, I moved around a lot, seventh or eighth grade. And I was in a middle to upper class high school. We were told not to give money to the beggars in DC. Mm-hmm. And that's their words.
Yeah.
And I straight up gave money to, I knew at that age, I was like, that's fucked up. And so, like, I totally gave money to all of the people that I saw. And I was like, what, are you going to fucking bust me, send me home? Like, what the,
yeah.
I'm giving them money. This is ridiculous. But this concept of squirreling away your money, and that's how people, like, watch rich people sometimes. Like, they have money to spend on themselves, but then they squirrel away money in these ways that, like, they're like, I'm being frugal. It's like, you're just being selfish. Like, you know?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to, that reminded me of that, you know, I just wanted to bring that up too.
Totally. And I'm just going to say, hashtag not all rich people. Like, I know for a fact there are very generous rich people out there. But yeah, absolutely. There's a meme that I've seen that going around that's like, when I go out with my friend who grew up poor, it's like, and who is still poor, like, they cover the meal and say, like, I'm sure it'll work out. You'll get me back another time. When I go out with my friend who grew up with money, they're literally like, okay, I think you owe me like $2.27 because you definitely had more bites of that ice cream sundae or whatever. Just like the, like, calculations. And I've definitely witnessed that. Yeah, the amount of money. I mean, this is a story. We had a guy on my dad's race car crew after my dad's accident who stayed with us to, like, help out. And there was a benefit in my community after my dad's accident to help us get some money for hospital bills. And this family friend, this person who was staying with us, who's still, honestly, a good friend of the family, my mom and I really, stole a bunch of that benefit money because poor people are driven to do things that are not always seemingly the most moral things to do because poor people can are really fucking desperate, dismal situations. And I mean, talk about transformative justice. I mean, my mom forgave him. He wasn't able to pay it back and he continued to live with us. Like, and we're still friends to this day. So, like, and you know, she's never seen that money again. But so just like that example of doing something that is quote unquote, you know, bad. And it was bad. I mean, we needed that money, but he was also like helping us out at the house. And then my mom practiced compassion and forgiveness. And just like that whole thing just felt like that was like what I learned at such a young age, which people can have very different opinions about that, of whether that's bad or good, about how that all went down. But that's just something I remember very vividly being like, oh, he stole money. He's still going to live with us. He probably won't be able to pay it back. Great. Okay. Next. Think he's going to take me to school today. Awesome. You know?
There's a No Effects lyric. Desperate people have been known to do desperate deeds.
It's true.
So when she found that family and moved into their home, she shot a family and moved into their home. It's a song, this No Effects thing, where like a woman was so poor that she killed somebody just so she could live in their house because she had nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And then she got busted for it, obviously. Anyways, just a No Effects song. Punk rockers, they know what's up. And I really, really, really try to ask my neighbors to practice more compassion about that stuff, about people rifling through things or robbing.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, yeah, it fucking sucks. Somebody stole your fucking TV, go buy another one. But also, like, think about where people are at, where they're at that point where they're stealing things. Like, something's going on, you know? And I know that's a very hard thing for a lot of people to get to, but I, you know, a lot of the violence and crime that happens in some neighborhoods is just desperation for money. If it's an addiction problem, which is a disease, or needing to get enough money to buy formula or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I just noticed that we are already way over time. So I think we should wrap up, and I would love to know your like final thoughts. But what I want to say, to be really transparent and accountable, is that I do believe that I have class transitioned to an extent, certainly culturally, even though I also sort of had tastes of some elements of cultural, you know, middle class life growing up too. Just that my comment last week that seemed to like really kind of inspire this show based on the Facebook comments. And also we didn't even get to European perspectives, immigrant perspectives. So I would love to have some of our listeners on the show to talk about that stuff, to be honest.
We have no expertise in that. We just need people to come on and speak their truths.
Absolutely.
What the fuck
absolutely
do we know?
Right, right. But I would love to hear, yeah, we're two white girls in the U.S. So this is, you know, take that for what it is. Girls. But so I just want to acknowledge that that comment was less about my actual reality, because I have class transition to an extent, and more about, I think, a demonstration of what poverty does to your brain, which is that when I didn't get this job that was going to be the first job with like a good income and health benefits that I would have really ever had, especially in the city that it was in, because it would have been like affordable cost of living and it was just going to be this amazing thing. And when I lost that, it triggered this thing in my brain of panic and terror of how I'm going to pay the next bill, because that's what I witnessed, you know, sort of seeing my mom do growing up. And so that catastrophic thinking of like, I'm literally going to be poor forever, is a result of the way that poverty creates, like fucking messes up your neural pathways, and less about the fact that I am going to be fine. Like, I have a PhD. I am white. I am partnered with somebody whose family has money. I have an apartment. I've never gone hungry. Even growing up poor, I never went hungry. I always ate. So I have immense amount of privilege compared to people that live in like severe poverty. So I just want to be really transparent and accountable about that, but also talk about how that comment was also a result of poverty. So that's my sort of final thought. What do you want to say to wrap up?
My final thought will just be a comment on what you just said, in that, because I feel like I was giving my final thoughts every time you brought up a topic, but just like summarizing how I felt. But that is so fascinating. I'm glad that you shared that about like where your brain went, because my brain has never gone there. It's more been like, oh, I get to teach these classes, or I get to stay in Minneapolis, or I get to, you know, my brain would never even go there. I mean, I think it just proves the point. Like, this is the comparison. That's where your brain went. And somebody like me, the way that I grew up, I was thinking more about location, classes, colleagues. And even for you, when I was thinking about your future, knowing your background, I was like, she'll be closer to me and be by some queer people. Right. And like, that's the extent. Right. I never even thought about the financial stability.
Yeah.
Aspect of it.
Yeah, so. And it's not like those other things weren't exciting to me, but that was after work. Yeah,
no, just that. Yeah.
But especially this year, just hustling multiple jobs. I'm just so fucking tired. So I was like, oh, I can like not be tired, but alas, I'll be okay. I'm gonna be okay. So that was kind of a little bit more of a scattered episode, a little bit less organized, but I hope people got something from it. And seriously, if you ever want listeners, who especially those of you who commented on the Facebook thread, if you want to be on and talk about your experience with class, maybe that could be a theme month, class, different perspectives of class. I think that'd be amazing.
Yeah, we'll Skype you in.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's wrap up real fast, but like, what do they call it? Lightning round, RWL. RWL, go.
The only thing I've listened to is the Black Panther soundtrack.
Okay, you're on board. Great.
I skipped the song about when he says the B word a lot. 2 Chainz or whoever comes in. Okay,
it's so good.
But otherwise,
that beat is so good. I know. It's a bummer, though. Yeah. Anyway.
I'm watching a bunch of SNL clips with Charles Barkley because he's hosting SNL tonight. So Robert wanted me to like get up to date on how bad Charles Barkley is as an actor. And then I am reading, I sound like a broken record, but I'm actually reading more articles about the FCC and net neutrality, because they just put the new apparent net neutrality deregulations into the Federal Register, which means that now Congress can like pull out things to like sue over and stuff. Mm-hmm. So the net neutrality thing is back, but nobody's talking about it because they're just talking about whether to arm teachers or not in classrooms. Mm-hmm. But that's also a big thing that will in fact impact all of us. That's a commentary. Sorry. Yep. I'm done.
Okay.
Bye.
Great. I'm reading stuff that prepped for the episode. So this Bell Hooks book, Where We Stand, Class Matters, and David Roediger's also Class, Race, and Marxism, I was revisiting. watching Call Me By Your Name. I would love, maybe I'll do another RWL and put that in there so people can give me their comments. I'd love to chit chat about it with folks who saw it. And listening to Frank Ocean's cover of Moon River. It's gorgeous. You should check it out.
Done.
Great.
Oh, wait, you do that part.
Either way, WTF.
Power.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5.